Peter, Andrew, James, and John. I want to be clear up front because many people today confuse me with either James, who wrote the book of James, or James the Apostle, who was the son of Alphaeus. I am James, the son of Zebedee, who is first listed in the lineup of the Big 12 apostles. Little kids often learn the apostles by song. I am the James of Peter, Andrew, James, and John. Peter and Andrew were brothers, and John and I were brothers. The four of us were fishing partners on the Sea of Galilee before Jesus called us to be fishers of men.
James, the son of Zebedee, was one of the first disciples of Jesus and was one of Jesus' closest friends. His stories of events occurring in the middle of Jesus' ministry are from an insider's point of view.
I'm making a big deal of making sure you know who I am because so little is actually known about me. If you have studied the Bible, you know that Peter, John, and I were Jesus' closest companions. We were the three chosen to be with him at the resurrection of Jairus' daughter, the Mount of Transfiguration, and Gethsemane. You know a lot about Peter, and you know a lot about John, but what do you know about me, other than what I just told you? If you were to search the Bible, you would find me mentioned less than 10 times, other than the list of apostles. Jesus nicknamed John and me Boanerges, or Sons of Thunder. John and I once asked to sit at the Lord's side in his kingdom, which really ticked off the other apostles. I was with Peter, Andrew, and John when we asked about the time of the destruction of the temple. I was also with him on the Mount of Transfiguration. One time, John and I wanted to call down fire on the Samaritans because they rejected Jesus. I was the first of the apostles to die when Herod had me killed by sword. Frankly, that doesn't seem like a bunch of information about someone who was in the inner circle of Jesus. No long stories, no personal details, no juicy quotes. Most people would be a little offended at that. But I can't really blame the gospel writers, especially Luke. I was the quiet, reliable one who Jesus depended on. If that sounds like you, I hope you realize that Jesus loves you and that you are in his inner circle, just like me. We are gifted for his glory, not our own. I was at the raising of Jairus' daughter. We apostles were just getting used to watching Jesus do miracles and heal people when he called all 12 of us together and did another amazing miracle. He gave us the authority and power to cure diseases, heal the sick, and cast out demons, and then sent us to go share the kingdom. I admit, I was pretty scared when he did that because he added the commandment for us to take nothing with us. No money, no extra clothes, no toothbrush. We were to be totally reliant on God and on God's people. When we returned, it was a joyous celebration because God had blessed our journey beyond anything we could imagine. Now you think that after that experience, we would understand that the power of Jesus and believe in him unconditionally. If you think that, you would be wrong. Shortly after returning, Jesus took the 12 to Bethsaida, which was a few miles east of our base at Capernaum. Bethsaida was the home of Peter, Andrew, and Philip. Although Jesus wanted to teach the 12 of us in private, a large crowd of people gathered, and Jesus welcomed them. As usual, when Jesus began to teach, the time just seemed to slip away. When it got near dinner time, we apostles could see that an emergency was developing. The crowd had no food, and there were no nearby towns to get food. Even if there had been, it would have been overwhelmed with the demands of thousands of people. We went to Jesus and explained the situation. Jesus was so compassionate. And we were positive he would be impressed with our compassion. Instead, he just looked at us with a grin and said, "You give them something to eat." After our recent trip where we did incredible miracles, you would think we would have just said, "Okay," and done it. But we looked at him as if he had lost his mind. With a disappointed sigh, he patiently had us place the thousands of people into smaller groups of 50, bless the 5 loaves and 2 fish that we had on hand, and had us start distributing food. After everyone had eaten, each of us gathered up exactly 1 basket full of excess. Then he grinned again. And we knew we were supposed to learn an extra lesson, but we were not exactly sure what it was. From that point on, we understood Jesus had no limits. But we were again underestimating even that. Physical miracles were relatively easy to understand. We could see them with our own eyes. What we couldn't understand was who Jesus was. In order to prepare us, he once asked the relatively benign question of who people said he was. He had heard people shouting names like John the Baptist, Elijah, and Moses. We knew better. And Peter voiced our opinion that he was the Messiah. I say opinion because not all of us were firmly convicted that we were actually in the presence of someone who the Jews had been seeking for many centuries. Nonetheless, Jesus must have considered it a good start. He began to teach us that the Messiah would be different than what people were expecting. He taught us about the suffering and servant Savior that Isaiah had prophesied. What we continued to imagine was a victorious warrior Messiah who would toss the Romans out of Israel. And while he was at it, install we 12 apostles as his seconds in command. The more he taught suffering and serving, the more we thought the Romans would be the ones doing that. When Jesus began to talk about his impending death, we shut out all those thoughts completely. To further our lessons in Messiahship, about a week after we began the discussion on who Jesus was, he took Peter, John, and me up to the top of a mountain. Jesus began to pray and things began to happen. Before our very eyes, Moses and Elijah appeared. Don't ask me how we knew that's who it was, but we knew for certain. Peter began mumbling some nonsensical thoughts because he was so stupefied. But mostly we just sat and watched and listened. When it came to a close, God's voice came to tell us that Jesus was his son and we should listen to him. It was so amazing that we decided not to tell anyone what had happened. We also agreed to listen to Jesus even more closely. I have to admit that following Jesus for the first few years, it was a pretty good job. We got to watch him do miracles and heal people, and even got to do them ourselves. We also got to watch Jesus rebuff the arrogant Pharisees whenever they questioned his teaching. The women who followed us took care of our food and clothing, and the weather in Israel was quite good enough to sleep outside most of the time. Most of us had led lives of poverty and hardship, so following Jesus was an upgrade to first class. It all changed in the 3rd year, though. And that is partly what Jesus had been preparing us for. His lessons about a suffering Messiah were a good start, but then he began to really prepare us for the hardships of discipleship when he'd be gone. It all started innocently enough. Jesus, Peter, John, and I came down from the mountain experience to a start of a new reality. We found the other apostles and disciples gathered around a demon-possessed boy. His father frantically explained how the boy was his only son, and when an evil spirit seized him, he would scream and convulse and foam at the mouth. He said that the spirit rarely left the child. and would soon destroy him. We had heard such stories before, so the three of us weren't too worried. But the father continued with the fact that the other apostles had not been able to cast out the demon. That stopped us in our tracks. Jesus sighed and seemed so disappointed. He wondered aloud how much more he could take of people with little faith. And we took it for granted that he meant all of us apostles too. I felt ashamed to be included in the group of people with little faith. But the event proved to be another learning lesson, because Jesus prayed and healed the boy, and the crowd praised God's greatness. Looking back, I think Jesus wanted us to understand the words of the boy's father. When he was urged by Jesus to believe, the father simply said, "I believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." I thought the incident was over and expected the crowd to drift away. While the crowd was still cheering, Jesus motioned the disciples to the side and said in a quiet voice, "Listen very closely to what I am about to say." At those words, the 12 of us stepped in very closely so we wouldn't miss a word. "The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days, he will rise." Stupefied. We were stupefied. Jesus had just finished a miraculous healing, and the crowd was cheering in the background. He should have been smiling, but he was talking nonsense. The Son of Man? Was he talking about himself? Was he really predicting that someone would murder him? Rise from the dead? We were at a total loss for words. Even Peter. We were so mystified, we didn't even ask him what he meant. To prove our absolute inability to understand our master, it wasn't long before we started arguing amongst ourselves again. Who would be the greatest in the kingdom? Jesus knew what we were arguing about, so he said, "Whoever wants to be first must be last and the servant of all." He then called over a small child who was nearby and said, "Whoever welcomes this child in my name welcomes me and the one who sent me. For the least among you all, he is the greatest." When Jesus said those words, I looked at my brother John and gave him a look of exasperation. How come everything Jesus said so confounded me? Why did his take on reality so conflict with my own? His answers were always so completely different from mine. I should have noticed that my answers weren't working so well, and I should have been able to understand that I should welcome a different viewpoint. I was prideful, too prideful. I mentioned you can't read much about me in the Bible, and I've already told you about most of the places where you can. So I want to close by talking about another of those times. We were walking through Samaria on our way to Jerusalem. You may recall that the Samaritans and the Jews were antagonistic to one another for a variety of reasons. Nonetheless, Jesus sent some people ahead to a village to make preparations for us to eat and spend the night. There weren't any hotels or motels at that time, and taking care of a few dozen people was a major undertaking for a village. Once the villagers understood that they were having to greatly inconvenience themselves for a bunch of Jews, they decided not to. This wasn't necessarily a theological disagreement, just a rude way to treat travelers. This is when my brother and I earned our nicknames from Jesus. We were furious and wanted to bring destruction down on the village. This wasn't an empty threat, because we had already proven that we could do such a thing. Jesus rebuked us and said, "You sons of thunder, we come to bring life to people, not death." That is when it struck me. All of Jesus' ministry could be summed up in that phrase. We come to bring life to people, not death. By saying we, I figured that It was no longer what would Jesus do, but what will we do? From now on, we, the apostles, would be bringing life to the people. I also figured that if we were bringing life to the people, the religious leaders had been giving death to people. So they needed to be replaced. They were not going to go quietly. It became clear that we were on a collision course with the Pharisees and other Jewish leaders. Most experts believe Stephen was the first Christian martyr. It is possible that I was the second one when Herod had me killed by the sword. It is clear that I was the first of the apostles to die for the cause of Jesus. In fact, I am the only faithful apostle whose type of death is known with certainty. It seems a little ironic that you might know almost as much about my death as my life. But I finally beat out Peter and John in something. I certainly got to be with Jesus again before them.